True Crime Podcast deals with sensitive issues, including some that little ears shouldn't hear. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
Hey guys, it's Melissa
and Mandy
with the Moms and Murder Podcast. We're a true crime podcast that's sure to make you laugh without compromising the seriousness of the content.
Despite our name, we aren't just for the moms. Our show is for all the Diet Coke drinking, chicken loving, Dateline watching people in your life. Come for the murder and stay for the witty humor and pop culture references.
And you never know, you may even hear from some of your favorite names in the world of true crime. Like Dateline's Josh Mankiewicz.
Do you have a preference on what we call you, Josh Mankiewicz, Manx, Sir Manx a lot?
I don't hear Sir Manx a lot quite as often as I
I can make it happen for you.
Like
I will make it happen.
But...
Broken Homicide's Derek Lavasser.
Are you tearing up on me? I saw you waiting.
So beautiful, everything you're saying.
Or even America's sweetheart, Allie Sweeney.
The neighbor suggested that perhaps Kathleen had been attacked by an owl.
The owl theory that Melissa and Allie Sweeney believe.
Again, so judgy.
Check out Moms and Murder anywhere podcasts are found.
Trying to change anybody's mind. We're just trying to understand it.
At We Too, we aim to explore gender differences in our current world. We want to hear stories, differing opinions, new ideas. We want to hear what you have to say, because you have a voice. And guess what? It matters.
Look for We Too Podcast, WETOO Podcast, on social media, and on your favorite podcatchers.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I am pretty darn good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Yay.
Yay.
Anything new?
No.
Oh, I got
nothing.
Well, guess what I watched? We could talk about this for a second.
What?
Making a Murder 2.
I'm in
Netflix.
The middle of it.
Oh, I got to tell you.
I know that Kathleen Zellner is something else, isn't she?
I just have so many questions.
Oh, yeah. Well,
a lot.
I've always believed that Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey were innocent. I don't think Stephen is a good man by any way, shape, or form, but I don't think he killed Teresa Halibach. He might have done other horrible things in his life, but I don't think he killed her. I don't know what happened, but it wasn't him. That's my feelings.
Yeah. I'm at the last episode. Shut up. That's what you do. You pause real long. But that, and I can't tell you,
it's
and I'm dying.
Duty.
I know. And I'm dying to tell you because I can't, because it was so
You're
shocking
fun
for
of
me.
A person with disabilities. Thank you.
Are you kidding me? I totes have it too. It's just undiagnosed. Anyway, I hear that you have quite the tale to tell.
I do. I stumbled upon this case. And I kind of regret that I did. It got so deep and so involved.
Well, I'm very excited to say that this is going to be our true crime podcast first ever two-part episode. And how many pages did you end up doing?
28 pages.
28 pages.
When I found this on the internet and I started doing research, and I found every article that I read was completely different. There's one book called Limits of Sanity. It was written by one of the reporters that was there. So this is the
reporter side.
This is the truth as he saw it.
All right. I'm excited and thrilled and frankly kind of scared.
It's very graphic, and I didn't want this to be kill porn. a lot of the information had to be told because of the trial that preceded.
It was brought up in the trial.
Well, it was brought up in the trial, but you'll see.
I can't. Trust me, you'll see. I'm kind of nervous.
Another big warning. I know we have the disclaimer at the front. This story does have triggers. It deals with drug and alcohol. It deals with child abuse, rape, all sorts of.
So this might be an adult ears should maybe.
Not even listen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, this will be interesting because sometimes I can't stand some of that stuff. So we'll see.
It's really hard. And there's harm to children, which is difficult to take. This event happened in West Creston in British Columbia, Canada. And that's about 6 miles or 10 kilometers north of the U.S. border by Washington State. As of right now, the population of this farming town is close to 1,400.
Now today. That's small.
But it's also a part of a bigger area called Creston.
Okay.
Obviously. Dale lived in a small wooden shack in a remote farming community, like I said, in West Creston. He lived with his wife, Annette, and their 3 small children. The entire family stayed close and lived in the same area. I'll show a map on our website about how close it is, but they all lived either across the road or down the road. His wife's mother, his mother-in-law, lived right across from the house.
Mm-hmm.
His wife's soon-to-be divorced sister, Maureen McKay, lived down the road just a little bit with her daughter. Maureen's future ex-husband, he was a drinking buddy with Dale. So then about 200 yards past the McKay's place lived Shirley Wozniak.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley was 32 years old, and she was also Dale's wife, Annette's aunt.
Oh, okay.
Okay, even though they're the same age.
That happens. It's okay.
It happens. Shirley lived in a 5-room wooden cabin with her husband, Alex, and their 4 young daughters. On September 4th, 1970, in the morning, Dale left his family. They were all asleep, and he went towards the local logging companies to look for work.
Mm-hmm.
Since he wasn't employed full-time with a logging company, he would go just to job sites to see if he was needed. That day, he wasn't lucky. He headed back home. So not being employed didn't help Dale. Dale struggled with depression, and he would always try to drink it away at the local bars, which we all know you can't do that.
Just comes back the next day, worse. Right.
Even growing up, Dale had had problems with depression. He always felt rejected, persecuted, and when he got to be an adult, these feelings intensified.
Right. Was his family from around, did his parents live anywhere around them?
He was originally from Saskatchewan.
Okay.
No, as far as I know, they didn't.
I gotcha.
As he got to be an adult, the feelings intensified, and he would become aggressive and very hostile with his family and friends.
Ugh.
He also felt very inadequate in his marriage. He was almost sexually incompetent.
Oh, but he had 3 kids?
And he had three kids. And he always thought that if he drank, he could perform better in bed.
I guess he doesn't know the way that works then, does he?
Unless he's some kind of superhero, that's what he always thought.
Okay.
With all these feelings that he had, it's not surprising to know that 8 months earlier, in February of 1970, he had tried to commit suicide.
Oh.
He had spent some time at the Riverview Mental Hospital in Vancouver.
They didn't know at that time the stuff they do now. Not as much. Not near the medication and the help that they have today.
I don't even think they had medication besides electric shock therapy.
Well, they had heavy-duty stuff.
But, you know, he was an average husband. He was helpful around the house and very sweet to his children. But he'd go to drink and spend hours at the bar, and he'd come home and he'd be belligerent. And
he didn't have a job. That could not be good.
Exactly. Yeah,
spending money drinking.
So after Dale came home from trying to find a job, his wife and her sister and Dale's smallest daughter needed to go into town because Dale's wife had an eye appointment. Mm-hmm. And then the ladies were going to spend the afternoon in the shops, just looking around at the shops. Since Dale didn't want to go shop, once they got into town...
Men usually don't.
Right. He handed the car keys to his wife and said, just go home. I'll find a way home. And he went to a bar. The events that I'm about to go into might seem a little bit monotonous. I think it's kind of important to the story due to the fact it kind of explains his mental state.
Status at the time, yeah.
Right. 3 o'clock that Friday afternoon, Dale enters a liquor store and he buys a 6-pack of beer and 12-ounce bottle of vodka. He then stops at the Kootenay Hotel Bar, which I hope that's how you say that, and sits with a friend talking about the upcoming morning, which is opening deer season or hunting season. And Dale was a huge hunter.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the best shots in the entire city. Or town, I should say, since it's a small town. And he was just a really good hunter, and he was very excited. He'd been in the area for 10 years, and he really knew the terrain, and he knew where it would be.
Good spots
and all that kind of stuff. So he wasn't going to, Dale said he couldn't stay at the bar for very long because he had to get to his sister-in-law's house to get his hunting rifle. And he had lent the rifle to Maureen McKay, mm-hmm. his sister-in-law, mm-hmm. because since she's going through the divorce, she always felt a little scared being out in the middle of nowhere
by herself
with just
kids.
Her daughter. Yeah. And I know you and I have done this all the time. We're just going to go for one drink. We can't stay long.
How many happy hours have turned into happy nights? Evenings?
1 hour and five beers later.
You drank five beers in 1 hour? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Dale became the good old back-slapping drinking buddy that he can sometimes be.
Okay.
He exchanged wisecracks with friends, and he was just being good-natured, which... You know, normally he would become belligerent and violent. So by 5:30 that afternoon, that's 2.5 hours later, mm-hmm. he was 10 beers in.
And he said he was only staying for a little bit, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A friend of Dale's came in and Dale bought him a drink. And as they were sitting at the bar talking, Dale said, "Hey, do you know where I can get some dope?" His friend said he didn't know, but he did tell Dale that he would take Dale home. But before Dale walked out of the bar, he ordered another six-pack of beer to take home.
Holy moly.
And he still had the other six-pack that he brought
from earlier
mm-hmm. plus the 12 ounces of vodka. Mm-hmm. But he was saving it for the next day when he went hunting.
Nothing says safe hunting like liquor and guns.
On the way home, he drank another beer in the car.
But he was being driven home, right?
Right. Since he lived close to Maureen's house, his friend just dropped him off.
And that's his sister-in-law, right?
That's his sister-in-law.
Okay.
At six to get the rifle. And as soon as Maureen saw him, she knew that he had been drinking. When he got to the door, he said, "Hey, I need the gun. I'm going to borrow it for a few days to go hunting." And Maureen invited him in the house, offered him coffee. Dale saw that Shirley Wozzeck was at the house. That's mm-hmm. his aunt-in-law, mm-hmm. I guess, mm-hmm. because she was there visiting Maureen and they were talking. So then Maureen came back with the gun. Dale checked the chamber, took all the bullets that were out of the magazine. He did safety checks. Then he set the gun down and proceeded to chat with the women for a little while. And he even bounced his little tiny niece that was there. He was bouncing her.
On knee, playing on horsey.
Little 7-year-old Tracy. By 7 p.m., Dale was back in town at a sporting goods store.
How did he get back into town?
He got his car from his wife.
So he's driving.
Right. Drunk. He's driving. Okay. Right. And he bought a box of 27-millimeter rifle shells. Mm-hmm. The man at the store mm-hmm. knew Dale, had known him for years. And he said that although Dale's breath smelled like alcohol, mm-hmm. he wasn't intoxicated. Which I have no idea how you're not intoxicated.
I would say he was intoxicated. Maybe he just...
Could hide it?
Yes.
Mm. So at 7:30, Dale stopped off at another auto shop that was owned by Armand Schaller. Once again, okay. Sorry if I mispronounced the names. Schaller went into the backyard with Dale to test out Dale's scopes and mm-hmm. see how accurate they were.
I see this could be
and he also, Schaller also noted that Dale had been drinking, but he couldn't have been drunk because his shooting was so accurate. He was hitting everything.
Really?
8 o'clock, Dale was at another shop. He needed to buy his back press and die that he had sold because he needed cash. A back press and die is something that helps you reload rifle bullets. Like you can reuse the cartridge and just reload the ammo. Mm-hmm. He also bought more bullets. Shop owner, once again, didn't think Dale was too drunk because he offered to fix a lamp for her, and it was very intrinsic and really hard to do, but he fixed it, no problem.
What?
But she did notice that when he was getting ready to leave, he had problems with the door latch. At 8:30...
Is he still drinking?
8:30, Dale went back to the liquor store.
Oh, my God.
This time, he bought 12 ounces of brandy.
What?
And a small bottle of wine.
How does one person consume all this?
I don't know. I really don't
know. Much less stay upright. Okay, go ahead.
9 o'clock, Dale went to the King George Hotel bar.
No!
And he sat by himself.
How is he not getting thrown out?
By the time he downs the fifth beer at this bar, he is up table hopping and chatting with all his friends. And they all said that he was more boisterous than usual, and he was happy. And
but let me guess, not that drunk.
Didn't say. Everybody was just kind of proud that he wasn't belligerent.
It's almost like he...
You know, or fighting with people.
Had a
that he was joking and... Yeah.
Wow.
10:30, Dale leaves with two friends, and they go upstairs to one of the rooms.
Is it a girl or a boy?
Two boys.
Oh, okay.
One was actually Maureen McKay's soon-to-be ex-husband.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was a man named Rex Phillips, which is interesting because after what happened,
uh-huh.
Rex kind of disappears and nobody has seen him since.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I don't know if it's John McKay or Alex Phillips that has the room that's in, okay, upstairs.
One, so of them.
One of them has the room. But before going upstairs, John McKay picks up a case of beer to
Are
take upstairs.
Are you kidding me?
They play guitar. They're drunk.
They're just chilling out.
They drink more. They sing a song.
Okay.
They, John McKay said that Dale didn't drink that much in the hotel room. Maybe two beers and some brandy. But like I said earlier, normally Dale gets really aggressive and just ruins the evening. But this time he's not.
So he asked for drugs earlier. Did he get some and nobody knew?
As far as we know, he did not.
Oh, okay.
He asked for weed.
Oh, okay.
But the guy said, no, I don't know, but I'll take you home.
Okay.
By now it's 11:30 and Dale excuses himself because he's got a long drive home.
And he has to get up and go hunting, doesn't he?
He's got to go up and go hunt. Everybody has said that Dale had a high tolerance for alcohol.
That's really high.
And that he could drink a lot without showing any signs of impairment. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's recap.
Yeah, let's.
Okay. He bought a 12-ounce bottle of vodka.
Okay.
A 12-ounce bottle of brandy.
Okay.
A small bottle of wine.
Wait, and 2 ounces of hard liquor constitutes as a drink, right?
A shot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A small bottle of wine and a six-pack of beer at the liquor store.
Okay.
Well, actually, two six-packs of beer.
Yeah.
He drank it all except the brandy. Then, the afternoon at the Kootenanny Hotel Bar, or Kootenay?
Kootenanny.
At the Kootenay Hotel Bar, he had at least 10 pints of beer. Plus, he bought a six-pack to go. Then, that evening, he drank at least 7 pints of beer.
All right. Come on.
Now, that was all within 8 hours.
It was after 3 o'clock, right?
And right.
Yeah.
Now, okay. 11:30. Remember how I said that Dale felt that he
was persecuted in life?
Right.
Right.
And that he felt sexually inadequate unless he had been drinking.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Well, so now he's drunk.
Mm-mm.
Or he should be drunk. Well, he had a plan.
Okay.
That he came up with.
When?
As he was driving home.
And this is at the end of the night?
Yeah, he's driving home.
I'm not gonna like this. I can already tell.
He's driving home and he decides he's feeling amorous, I guess. So instead of going home.
Great.
He drove to his sister-in-law at Maureen McKay's house.
The one he was at earlier. His sister-in-law.
His wife's sister.
Great.
Lucky for Maureen, this is 1970, so they claimed that a friend just happened to drop by at 10:30 at night and they were up speaking to each other on the couch.
Was it
a boy.
A friend that was a male?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This old friend, his name was Frank Shaulier, and I don't know if he was related to the guy at the auto shop that Dale was with
probably,
earlier.
Probably, if that's a
Maybe.
Small town.
This man had been out of town attending a vocational school, and he had come home for the long weekend. He had driven about 300 miles to come home, and his first stop was at Maureen's house.
Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. Please tell me that's a good sign.
So the two friends were in the living room talking when they heard a car stop
mm-hmm.
and the sound of a car door closing.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 10 minutes after midnight and they weren't expecting anybody. So they
I would think not.
So they quit talking and they started to listen intently. And they soon heard footsteps on the wooden porch crossing over to the front of the door.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as the footsteps stopped, only silence. So they sat waiting for the visitor to knock, but instead they heard the footsteps retreating. Then Frank decided to check outside and look to see who it was. Now, there's no lights out here. It is completely dark.
Yeah,
it's in the middle of the woods.
Right.
It's way far out in the country. I'll post pictures of the cabin that these people were living in. They're one room places.
Rustic. Very
Extremely.
Rustic.
Extremely. They were pretty much just wood.
I mean, they
weren't fancy whatsoever. Any rooms that they had, they just pretty much partitioned off. There wasn't like dedicated rooms. So since it was all so dark outside, Frank went out there, but it was completely black and he really couldn't see so well at first. But once his eyes
adjusted,
he was able to tell that it was Dale because it was Dale's Chevy pulling away.
And he knew Dale.
He knew Dale. He knew the family, so everybody mm-hmm. was related. And he was able to see Dale's Chevy pulling away and going south down the road to the Wazik's house. So we don't know if Dale actually saw Frank on the porch.
We don't know
if
that.
He did, yeah.
Okay.
If Dale did see Frank, he never acknowledged him. Since Maureen was Dale's sister-in-law, she and Frank really didn't think much about Dale stopping by so late. They just knew that Dale was odd and chalked it up to that. So not 5 minutes later, Maureen's phone rang, and mm-hmm. it was Shirley Wozniak.
Mm-hmm. He went to his aunt's house, Shirley's house.
His sister's aunt's house.
Okay.
Young aunt. And that was Maureen's aunt also. Shirley seemed very anxious and told Maureen that Dale was coming through her yard.
Whose yard? To Shirley's house?
Yes. Dale got out of his car and was walking up.
To come see her. To see Shirley.
And she was nervous.
Why would she call Maureen?
Because Dale was a drunk and he was carrying a rifle.
But wasn't that his aunt?
It was. Dale is known to be very aggressive.
Okay.
They were scared of him.
I know. I'm confused as to why she would call him. And this is just me asking you questions. Like, it's Shirley calling Maureen. Why wouldn't Shirley call his wife?
Because she was with Shirley before, maybe? Or...
That's what I'm confused about.
Maybe they didn't have a phone?
I don't know. Okay, go ahead.
Shirley was only on the call for about 30 seconds before she hung up. Maureen knew that Dale was unpredictable, so she sent Frank up to check on Shirley and her girls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Shirley's husband was away on a trip and had taken one of the girls with him. So Shirley only had three girls at the house. Shirley's cabin was only 200 yards away, but Frank took his car because he needed to get there quickly. When he got to the cabin, he listened at the door to see if he could hear anything, but he didn't hear any movement or conversation. Nothing inside. It was complete silence.
Mm-hmm.
He knocked on the door and Shirley answered, and Frank could only see the outline of her because the light was coming from her back and there's no light in front.
In the house with her.
So Frank asked Shirley if her husband was home. Shirley told him no, that Alex wasn't, but Frank could see a vague shadow of a man off center from Shirley. And Frank said that the way that Shirley spoke to him was very brisk. He thought that she wanted him to leave. And that she was kind of shooing him away.
Oh, see, after that, before I would be scared, I would go the other way and say that there's something wrong.
Frank told Shirley goodnight and went back to Maureen's house.
Mm-mm. But Frank thought he saw a figure in there?
He thought he saw that there was a man there. Okay. So before Dale had come into the cabin, and when I say small, it was 36 feet by 29 feet.
So it's a room.
It is a room, but they have it blocked off.
Right, I got it.
Of all the cabins. Hers was the biggest.
Quite a big room? Tiny house.
Shirley was in bed with Charlene, who was 8.
Oh, God. Okay.
And it was a special treat to sleep with Mom, and she was in there because Dad was away.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy, who was 7, was asleep in her room that she shared with Charlene at the other side of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was partitioned off. And then Debbie was 12. She was in her bedroom right off of the kitchen. Debbie, even though she was supposed to be asleep, she wasn't asleep.
Mm.
She was drawing. When she heard the car coming down the road, Debbie went into the kitchen and saw her mother, Shirley, standing by the sink. And her mother was like trying to pull her robe on real quick.
Mm-mm.
Shirley told Debbie to hurry up and just get back in her room. She didn't want to go. She wanted to stay out there. She loved Dale. Dale was really nice. She went back into her room. Mm-hmm. But she was nosy, and so she would try to listen and try to figure out what Dale wanted. Debbie could barely hear what was going on, but she did recognize that it was Dale, and the conversation was a bit muffled. Debbie could kind of make out that her mother was offering Dale coffee to drink, like insisting that he drink coffee and asking questions, but Debbie couldn't really make out what it was. She couldn't really hear much of anything, but she did hear Dale saying something about a big pill.
A big pill.
A big pill, but she couldn't understand anything else. It was like muffled, and she thought she heard big pill. She wanted to say hello because she did love Dale so much. She heard a knock on the door, and so she saw Frank come in, heard that she said, no, Alex is gone. After all this, Debbie was still in the hallway, and the house went quiet. And then Debbie heard Shirley scream, no, Dale, don't.
Mm-hmm.
It was coming from Shirley's bedroom. Debbie moved closer, and she said she heard a strange gurgling noise.
Aww.
She commented later that it sounded like snoring. It was a weird sound, like snoring.
Mm-hmm.
When she moved closer, the noise kind of stopped. Then the house went quiet again, and Debbie walked into the kitchen. She didn't know what to do, so she kind of found a hiding space, like in between the wall and the refrigerator. Luckily, she did, because Dale and Charlene, the 8-year-old sister, came walking into the kitchen. And Debbie was going to jump out and scare both of them, kind of playfully. But then she noticed that Dale was kind of acting weird. He kind of looked funny, and he just wasn't his normal self, so it kind of scared her, so she stayed hidden. So at that point, she's listening to what's going on, and Dale was looking for, was looking in the kitchen for a knife. And then asked Charlene to help him find a very sharp knife. Time went by, and all of a sudden, Debbie saw that Dale had a long steel-bladed knife that had an elk horn handle. Then Dale had taken Charlene by the neck and, like, guided her back out of the kitchen and left. And about this time, Debbie came out of her hiding place, and she watched them as they went back into the back bedroom where Tracy was sleeping.
How old's Tracy?
7.
Oh, okay.
Debbie then, ever so quietly, tiptoed into her mother's room and closed and locked the door behind her, which is a good thing. Because once in the bedroom, Debbie saw her mom, Shirley, laying face down in a pool of blood. Her hands were tied with a cloth behind her back. Shirley's nightgown and robe had been pulled up over her hips, and a fire extinguisher was on her back. Debbie walked over to her mother and untied her hands. And even though there was a lot of blood at Shirley's head, Debbie could tell that Shirley was still breathing.
Oh, good.
Debbie turned her mother on her side
and
propped her head up with pillows. And while Debbie was doing this, she started to hear cries coming from her little sister's room. And Debbie knew she couldn't go through the front door. So what she did is she took the fire extinguisher and threw it out the window.
Did that make noise?
Broke the glass, and then Debbie pulled over a bench that was in the room and escaped out the window and ran down to Maureen McKay's house. So Frank and Maureen were still in the living room talking when they hear someone pounding at the front door. And when Frank opened up the front door, Debbie was gasping for breath, and she looked pale and
petrified,
frightened. When Maureen asked Debbie what was wrong, all Debbie could do was scream. And when they finally were able to get her settled down, Debbie finally told them that Dale had beaten her mother so badly that there was a ton of blood in the bedroom and that Dale was still at the cabin with her little sisters. That's when Maureen called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or Mounties, as they're known. Constable Moker answered Maureen's call. Immediately, he dispatched Constable McLaughlin to go in a police cruiser, while Mokler and Slomba, I think that's how, Slomba, S-L-O-M-B-A.
Those are some names. I don't know.
Went there in an unmarked vehicle. The constables were stationed about 15 minutes away. As they were approaching the location, a vehicle was approaching them. The car stopped suddenly and waved down the police. It was Frank and Maureen with Debbie in the back seat, and she was in shock. And they were on their way to take her to the hospital. Since the constables weren't familiar with the back roads, they said, "Turn around and take me to the house." So Frank and Maureen turned the car around, and they all went to the Wasik's house. As they got there, the first thing that went through their minds was, this is in the middle of nowhere. Hardly any houses are close. There's no lights. There are thick bushes, huge clumps of trees, the cabins in the woods. And if anybody's out there hiding, they couldn't see them, like lying in wait, that they are definitely
ambushed. They could get
target.
Ambushed.
Exactly. Right. They did notice as they pulled up that there was a blue Chevy parked by the fence. Well, Dale drove a blue Chevy. But other than that, there wasn't any sign of anyone in the house. As the RCMPs, or the Mounties, walked closer to the cabin, they saw little Charlene Wasik just on the inside of the fence, and she only had the top half of her pajamas on.
How old was she? 7?
She was 8.
8, okay.
She was dazed, and as soon as the police picked her up, she just crumbled and became hysterical. So the police turned to Maureen and Frank and have them take both girls to the hospital.
Right.
Constable Moker and Laughlin approached the cabin. They noticed that the front door was open just a teeny tiny bit. When they looked inside, they noticed it was neat and everything still looked normal. There was nothing turned over. But as Moker was the first to walk into the living room, he glanced and he was able to see the bare legs of Shirley in her bedroom. And she was lying across the bed with very extensive head injuries. When he checked her pulse, there was no sign of life. And then Moker noticed that the window was broken. He then headed into the girl's bedroom. When he got in there, he saw an empty bed that had all the sheets and blankets pulled off the bed and onto the floor. As his eyes went and gazed about the room, he saw another bed. And there, little 7-year-old Tracy Wasik was lying in her own blood. She had a 9-inch cut that started from her chest down to her pelvis. Her internal organs were protruding from the incision. And she had also been cut from her left ear across her mouth and to her other ear.
Why?
Like the Black Dahlia, remember?
Oh.
Like next to her small body lay a blood-stained knife with the elk horn handle.
Where's Butthead?
Dale, no sign. Constable Moker knew that the first priority was getting to Dale's house to check on Dale's family.
No, no.
He immediately called for more RCMPs. The three officers that were there went to Dale's family. The road was dark and deserted, remember, no lights, and they had problems finding it. When they finally got there, they found everybody safe. One of the officers took the entire family back. They went back to the Wasik's house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got there, they found out that Dale's blue Chevy that was there mm-hmm. was gone.
Okay.
And the only vehicle that was their unmarked police car.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. They don't know either. As the officers were walking back to the Wasik's house,
mm-hmm.
Moker noticed that there was a fresh trail of blood leading from the doorway down the front of the steps. Okay. It hadn't been there 15 minutes before. Moker went back into the cabin and looked around. Shirley was still there. Her lifeless body was still on the bed, still where it was. Then he went into the girl's room and discovered that Tracy's body was gone.
What?
Tracy's body was not there.
I know, I got that.
But it was gone.
So he came and got it?
He followed the blood trail.
Oh, geez.
It went from Tracy's bed, across the living room, down the steps, through the yard, and right into an unmarked police cruiser.
Are you kidding me?
Inside the police cruiser, there was bloodstains on the front seat and smears of blood on the steering wheel.
What?
Constable Moker thought Dale had grabbed Charlene and took her somewhere out into the woods.
Right.
Once he heard the sirens of the police car go off, and that somehow Charlene had struggled to escape. That was the first time, right? Like when the police first got there with the sirens, and then she had managed to escape. So when the officers went to Dale's families to put them into safety, Dale went back into the house, grabbed Tracy's body, and mistakenly got into the police vehicle.
Because he was in a hurry.
Because he was in a hurry and he was stressed. And then once he realized that his key didn't fit the ignition, he got out and went back into his own car and drove off. At this time, the Mounties start to become very concerned about everybody in the area. And since it was so remote, they had no way to guard everyone.
Mm-hmm.
They called Corporal French at about 12:50 and notified him about the murders. By 1 o'clock, he had called all the off-duty Mounties into the station.
Mm-hmm.
Each man was issued a rifle and warned of the dangers that they would be facing when they would be out looking for Dale. They were all instructed not to shoot unless they were shot at. French then set the men to be stationed at certain routes out on the West Creston area.
Mm-hmm.
Finch even alerted the police in Washington, Idaho, and Montana, putting out a warning that the suspect was armed and very, very dangerous. Finch was about to leave and go investigate the Wysick's place when the phone rang at the station. On the other end of the line was a woman who was scared, very, very scared, and she was whispering into the phone.
No, no.
Finch tried to get her to tell him what was going on, but she was too afraid to even talk. And finally, the caller said that she was at the Phipps house in West Creston. And then before hanging up, she stated, "There's a man here with a gun." Finch tried to call back, but there was no answer. And he knew that the armed man was Dale. And so he quickly set out to the Phipps house with Constable Schwartz. So the Phipps family lived in a small cabin, and when I say small, this one was 24 by 18.
Oh, that's tiny.
And it was right down at the end of the same road as the Wasik's. The family consisted of Ray Phipps, who was 42, his common-law wife, Isabel St. Amand, she was 27, and four children, Paul 10, Kathy 8, Brian 7. Now, these three were Isabel's children from a previous marriage,
mm-hmm.
and they also had one together. He was 18 months old, and his name was Roy.
Roy.
They all lived on a road called Corn Creek Road.
Now, did Dale know these people?
They were neighbors, but I don't know if they knew each other or not. Okay. I'm assuming they did.
But, I mean, he wasn't, like, good friends with them or anything.
As far as I know, they're not. Okay. They never spoke about it. Corn Creek Road, they aren't paved. It's just dirt. There's potholes. There's ruts. There's
basic country road.
The street roads, the street names weren't marked. But when they finally found the Phipps house, the lights were on and the front door was open.
Mm. And this is like what time? 1 o'clock in the morning?
1:30, somewhere around there. There wasn't any movement outside. The only movement actually were, as they pulled up, there were cows in the front of the cabin. That's how rural this place was. They get out of the car and, of course, scared to death because they're just targets at this point.
Right.
I mean, they have no idea what's out there.
Well, they don't even really know what they're fighting. I mean, they know it's Dale,
but they don't. Yeah. He could be anywhere. They have no idea where he's at. And he could be anywhere in the woods waiting to ambush them and shoot them. Finch was the first officer to the door. As he looked inside, he saw Ray Phelps laying sprawled just inside the door. The top of Ray's head, his skull, had been shot off.
Ugh.
And from the position of the body, it looked as though he was shot point blank.
Range. So he probably answered the door.
As soon as he opened the door, boom, he was shot. They didn't know for sure if Dale was in the cabin, so they slowly went inside. And, I mean, small cabin. I mean, it's just basically
a room.
Big room.
Right.
And once inside the door, he saw the body of Isabella St. Armand, and she was lying by the stove. She was shot in the head from behind, and it looked like she was trying to escape.
Mm.
Then Finch turned and looked into another smaller room that was sectioned off,
mm-hmm.
and he saw a crib and a bunk bed. As he approached the crib, he saw that little baby Roy was inside, and he had been, he was dead due
he
to
killed a the baby?
Gunshot wound.
He killed the baby?
Actually, it said that from the position of the baby, that the baby had sat up and looked at him, and he still pulled the trigger and shot him.
Oh my God.
Finch went to the bed to find Paul, the 10-year-old. He was also shot in the head, and then he saw Brian. He was on the top bunk. Also dead.
What is his problem?
And then as Finch looked at the bottom of the bunk, he noticed the blankets on top of the bed had been thrown onto the floor. The bottom sheet and pillow were still rumpled on the mattress, but there wasn't any blood or any signs of struggle. It didn't look like there was any violence. And he had no idea at the time that there was another person that was supposed to be at that house. Well, once they talked to the neighbors, he discovered that 8-year-old Kathy also lived there and she was missing.
Mm.
But all evidence pointed to her being still alive. So they had hope
mm-hmm.
that Dale had just kidnapped her and taken her as a live hostage.
Mm-hmm.
In 90 minutes from the time he left the bar to this time right now, Dale had killed 7 people.
Oh, my.
And the cops realized that there was an armed assailant in the dark in a heavily wooded area, maybe in his car, maybe not. He had a little girl who was terrified with him, and he also had a mutilated body of another little girl in the car with him, or wherever he was.
And he had daughters, right?
I'm assuming so.
No, Dale did.
But he had 3 small children. It never really stated that if he had daughters or not. Early the next morning, the police had all the roads blocked. All vehicles were searched. The remaining residents of West Creston were either locked since or they went to stay elsewhere until the manhunt was over and Dale was found.
Right.
They had officers that went interviewing people door to door. They had officers that were going over the crime scene and those that weren't doing any of it going on a manhunt. Dale's family and friends told the officers that they didn't think Dale would be taken alive. They said that he would probably kill himself.
Good.
And most of the people agreed that Dale's death by his gun or by a Mountie's gun would be the best thing
could
happen.
Would be.
Locating Dale was very difficult. Dale had taken his car. They couldn't have dogs track him. The officers basically said, if we could find Dale's car, we can find Dale. Once you get into a car, dogs can't track your scent.
Right.
So the officers had the task of finding Dale's car in this huge area, and they had no idea where to start. And they knew that it could take several days to find him. So by chance, as Finch was going back to Phipps' cabin, the family that he shot down the road, he noticed fresh tire tracks that headed right towards a broken fence. He figured out that it was probably Dale that caused the damage to the fence. Then he knew that that's where Dale was headed. 2 o'clock that Saturday, Finch had chartered a spotter plane to go over the trees in the search area.
Mm-hmm.
But, small town, this plane did not have any radio equipment.
So if they saw something up in the air, they couldn't tell anybody?
They couldn't tell anybody.
Oh, geez.
Somebody watched the plane as it flew into this heavily wooded forest, and they were watching it go back and forth, and then after a bit, they noticed the plane dipped down to almost the treetop level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they saw the pilot start yelling and waving frantically and pointing, and then the officers and their dogs started heading in that direction.
Okay.
And then about 2 miles into this forestry access road they were taking, they noticed Dale's car. It was off in a ditch, and it looked like that Dale had tried to turn the car around, but got stuck.
Good.
They knew, they expected anyway, to find Dale had killed himself in the car, and that he had...
But he's a giant wimp, and I bet he didn't.
That he committed suicide. But they still went very cautiously to the car.
Mm-hmm.
Once they opened the door, they did not find Dale in the car. He was not in there.
Was that little baby girl?
Cindy wasn't inside either. Neither was Tracy. They didn't find any bodies, but there was blood covering the entire passenger side of the car. Mm-hmm. It was on the door. It was on the floor, the seat. It was mm-hmm. everywhere. In the center of the front seat mm-hmm. sat two empty rifle shell boxes and a hammer.
A hammer?
Oh, geez. Closer examination of the hammer.
No.
Let them know that Cindy was probably dead.
Are you kidding me?
There was bloody hair found all over the hammer. The officers soon started walking every inch of the area where the car was found. And by 4:30 p.m., about 40 feet from the car, a young Mountie officer found the arm of a child.
An arm?
It had been hacked from the torso by a sharp knife. About 20 feet from the arm lay a young girl's head that had been neatly severed from the neck. No more than 20 feet later, a leg was found.
Oh, my.
Then the torso with the remaining limbs.
Are you kidding me?
They found Tracy Wozzeck. There was no attempt to hide her body at all.
He had a mental break or something.
They found the parts of the body were almost in a semicircle. Like he just
did it on purpose.
Like he just her body parts out of the car.
What?
And then they searched the area until nightfall, hoping to find Cindy, but they never
found
her.
And or him.
No luck on either count. Later, after they picked up Tracy and brought her to autopsy, and the forensic expert there, it was found that Tracy's heart and her external genitalia had been cut out, but those parts were never found, ever. Like, the dogs never found them, nothing. And nobody knows for sure what Dale did with those parts.
I know what he did with them.
And what you think he did is what the police think he did.
He's mentally unfit.
There's something not right. So anyway, that's part one. We'll go into the manhunt and the trial after.
I have so many questions. I don't even know where to start.
Do you have any for this?
A lot. A lot. Like, you can get as drunk as you want, and nothing would make anybody get that drunk and do that. He had to have a break from reality or like a psychotic break. Something happened. That is not normal.
That isn't normal. And I've always heard.
He was a belligerent drunk, but a murderer does not a belligerent drunk make.
Exactly. I have heard that no matter the amount of alcohol or drugs that a person consumes would ever make you do something that you would not want to do sober.
No. Except maybe kiss an ugly boy, but that's another story.
Well, you might just want to kiss somebody.
Yeah.
But surely not.
Not that. That's just, that is.
And it gets worse.
Oh, I don't know if you can.
I hope you all forgive me. I did not know the intensity or graphicness of this until I actually read this book. It's pretty graphic, and it's...
You might have to do the second
and then
episode
you wonder
by
why
yourself.
You wonder why it took me so long to write. It was horrifying. I usually can do...
How old was he?
31.
Oh, my God.
I usually can take events like this and distance myself from them, but this one was really hard mentally to do.
Well, you've done pretty darn good so far.
Well, thanks.
All right. Well, I guess we'll stay tuned to hear the rest of this horrid tale.
Awful.
It is awful.
Well, we'll play it tomorrow, right?
Yeah. I don't feel very upbeat with our sign-off.
No.
So, yeah.
Okay. You know where to find us. Come back tomorrow. We'll tell you the rest of this heartbreaking story.
I hope he's dead.
He is now.
All right. Well, don't forget to lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
It's not like I've ever...
been wrong. Wrong!
Hurt.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll cut that out. I can't hear.
I know. Neither can Psycho Billy.
Okay. I gotta take a drink. Yeah, he's one sick motherfucker.
I know.
Feel like lost or something.
That's the whole trial. Was he insane or was he not insane? Are you done with the ice?
Mm-mm. I got heartburn.